How flexible is your device? Are you a person on the move and need your device to move with you? The Mesa Fundi goes wherever you go. It allows you to take notes, sketch your great ideas, sign documents and get work done wherever you are. Attach Microsoft Office for the ultimate experience. Make the shift and upgrade to the Mesa Fundi with Windows 10 Professional. The Mesa Fundi, flexibility reimagined. Available online and in store at all leading retailers. Mesa recommends Windows 10 Professional. Visit mesa.co.za for more information.
What's going on? I can't travel to Durban and I really need to see the team. Our telephone bill is through the roof, our server crashed and we've lost all our files.
Are you getting frustrated with problems in your business? Win at work and calm the chaos with Vox's intelligent business solutions. Work smarter, not harder, and connect your business to the world from 899 Rand. T's and C's apply. Visit vox.co.za for more information.
I'm Duncan McLeod, and this is the Tech Central podcast. I'm joined now by Wilhelm Krieger, who is the Chief Information Officer at banking giant Absa, to talk about the demerger, if I can call it that, with Barclays and the huge IT project that was needed to accomplish it. Wilhelm, good to chat to you today, and thanks for making the time.
Yeah, thanks to be here.
Now, it seems to me that Absa, since its creation in the early 1990s, has been perpetually in a state of some kind of mergers or demergers. In fact, the group was the amalgamation originally of four smaller banks in South Africa in the early 1990s. I think it was around 91, 92. And that obviously was a very different era to where we are now from a technology perspective. But I imagine it had its own set of IT challenges at the time. Does this sort of stuff, this all this integration, acquisitions, mergers, demergers, etc., make the life of the job of a CIO that much more difficult?
Yeah, certainly. And specifically referring to the original amalgamation, I mean, we still today have the overhang of some legacy systems that was put together, you know, picked one or the other at that time. So certainly it creates some complexity. And, you know, again, with the demerger created significant complexity in terms of getting things untangled again. So tanglement and entanglement always is difficult in the life of a technologist.
Yeah. So hopefully there's a period of quiet coming ahead for Absa now that you've got this latest project out of the way. But let's look a little bit at the background here. So Barclays, which is a large British banking group, about 15 years ago now, bought a majority stake in Absa. It was fairly controversial at the time, as I recall. Tito Mboweni, who was the Reserve Bank governor back in at the time, around 2005, I seem to recall, expressed some reservations about it. But the deal did go ahead, and Absa became Absa Group became Barclays Africa Group, though the Absa name did stay in the South African retail context. The acquisition resulted in Barclays, in effect, taking over Absa's IT function and moving some, if not a lot, of that IT function offshore to the UK. Well, Helen, maybe take us a bit back in history here and as to what happened post the Barclays deal in those years afterwards, in terms of from an IT perspective, what happened. I do recall that a lot of the infrastructure and processing was moved to the UK, but maybe just take us through a bit of the history of what happened.
Yeah, like with any big takeover or big shareholding, obviously there's a big drive for efficiencies from the majority shareholder. They have systems, which they deem superior. They want to get economies of scale. So it was obviously a big drive to try and consolidate. They manage a whole host of the infrastructure from central points, again, for the sake of efficiency. So the big impact was not so much in our retail bank, which remained fairly autonomous from a systems perspective, but certainly at the time our investment bank was young and fledgling and therefore, you know, started using the Barclays, CIB or corporate investment bank systems. So great entanglement there. At that point in time, Barclays also owned the African countries. Only later that South Africa acquired the where we formed the Barclays Africa Group. So those were directly done from PLC and obviously running on all Barclays PLC systems. So big impact in our African countries. a big impact in our functional areas, because that's where they try to get economies of scale. You know, interesting story is, you know, 2 years before the demerger, they decided that we need to go on a single HR platform, and it took us a year to effectively move our HR onto the Barclays HR. Just to 2 years after that, take another 2 years to untangle it again. So again, I think that's just an indication of how the big the impact is. So yeah, definitely the acquisition, obviously trying to get that economies of scale, and then at some point in time deciding the marriage is over and moving on, and putting us in a position where we had to spend significant time, 3 years in fact, to detangle all of the entanglement that happened since they took over.
I'm guessing it wasn't simply a case of reversing what had happened.
No, so definitely not. And for me, that's one of the lessons learned. Potentially, if you take a look at something like this, is marriages don't always last. A year before they decided to sell us, we were one of the top three priorities, or Africa was one of the top three priorities. Priorities changed, and they moved on. And you know, it's well known that they had to write a big check for us to do this disentanglement and obviously stay involved for 3 years, irrespective of the fact that they moved the shareholding very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So, I think it poses a challenge to technologists and how they design their solutions, and even to us as we now embark on Africa and deal with African countries, is to make sure that, you know, sometimes you change your mind. You should be able, and you should architect in such a way and plan in such a way that you can decouple quickly. You don't want to spend 3 years detangling something that you've just put together. So I think it brought a bit of a different perspective, having gone through this journey, to really think about how you set yourself up, even us now from an Africa group perspective. And, you know, should we change our mind on a country, or should something happen that we have to move in another direction, you've got to be flexible enough to be able to do it, not write a big check and spend 3 years, untangled.
Yeah. So how do you go about building that flexibility into your IT infrastructure?
Yeah, I think it's careful planning, it's architecting. You can still get economies of scale, but it's making sure that you construct in such a way that you can separate easy. You might have shared platforms, but you set it up that you can decouple and pass it on. And I think technology nowadays make it very possible. Things like cloud and containerization help you to be able to achieve that a lot simpler. So it's thinking a bit about how you architect and how you do these things, but setting up in a way that you can move in another direction quickly. Otherwise, it becomes difficult and complex.
You mentioned cloud out of interest. So you, as part of this process, have you moved a lot of your systems into hyperscale cloud environments? Maybe take us through in a little detail what you've done there.
Yeah, so I think this actually accelerated our thinking around cloud. I mean, at the time when the announcement was made, certainly it wasn't as prevalent as it is today, and it was early days. But one of our big challenges was actually to set up infrastructure in the right way. To be able to move things quickly and decouple applications, and cloud certainly became part of our thinking as part of that journey. And I think this past couple of years we moved cautiously forward. I think we've done a lot of investigation, a lot of POC to make sure that we can safely use the cloud. And we had a very much a hybrid cloud strategy, with some stuff in public cloud, some stuff on-prem. But I think throughout that, we're now in a position where we're comfortable to accelerate that journey to public cloud, and that's the next phase of our strategy. So we used some of it during the decoupling, but certainly it laid a great foundation for us to now accelerate our move forward, and that's the plan. That's part of the strategy.
Interesting. I'm gonna give away my age to some extent here, Wilhelm. Back in the mid 1990s, I think it was around the mid 1990s, Alwyn Berger, who I think was the chief information officer at ABSA at the time, gave me a tour of the facilities down at your downtown head office, and he took me down to the where the mainframes were in the basement underground. I seem to recall him saying that they were actually capable of surviving a nuclear blast, and it was a really interesting tour. But you guys had huge water-cooled mainframes down there at the time. And I visited there probably about 7 or 8 years ago again, and I was was amazed to see this huge data center under your head office building had shrunk down into a couple of I think still mainframes, but sitting in a tiny corner of the basement. Are those going to disappear entirely now as you move to the cloud, or will you continue to maintain some of your own infrastructure on site?
So it's an interesting journey. I mean, we're no longer in our basement. We 3 or 4 years ago started to move into a more modern facility in Samran. So that was first part of the shrinking. I think we started off with 16,000 square meters of data center space. We're probably down to 2.5 now. So it's continuously shrinking. Obviously, it's one of our projects that we're driving now is also to ready ourselves for a more aggressive move to the public cloud. So, you've seen technology shrinking. You've seen different technologies, and I guess we'll end up with 1,500 square space. We still have a mainframe, by the way. A lot of our retail bank applications still use the mainframe. It's a reliable technology that we still use. But we are starting to move things away, re-architecting some of the solutions away and moving to more modern technology. But the mainframe is certainly still part of our world. But data center space is quickly disappearing. And the days of owning big data centers is gone. Obviously with public cloud and then other facilities that are available where you can lease space if you really do need some physical presence. So all part of our strategy, again, that shrinking is happening at a tremendous pace.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that Barclays cut a big check to APSA to help with the demerger. I believe it was an amount of 12.6 billion with a B to pay for the separation. Did most of that go into the IT project?
Yeah, predominantly two big spending areas, tech. Nothing happens today without technology underpinning it. So a big part of it went to tech, and then obviously brand. The rebranding of specifically the African countries, some of those countries like Kenya had the Barclays brand for 400 years or more, and were very strong. So a big component also went into the rebranding of those countries, and obviously rebranding of things locally. I mean, even in South Africa, we were on a journey to go from red to blue. Our head office and some of the branches were starting to reflect Barclays, and then it all went back again. Obviously, in the countries, it was all Barclays. So a big part of that, but the lion's share of that going into tech projects and moving applications and rebuilding applications. So yeah. It was the biggest, the lion's share of the spend in tech and brand.
So this must have been one of the biggest IT projects ever undertaken in South Africa. How did you scope it initially, and maybe take us through some of the work that was involved in doing this, and how many people were involved?
So very interesting. I mean, we initially when the announcement was made, and I was fortunate enough to be. To be involved from the word go, we stared at this thing and I think we were surprised at the level of integration that we did achieve during the reign under Barclays. It catches you. Suddenly you realise, hell, there's a big job to be done here. But planning took us about 9 to 12 months. We planned, and it was like, let's understand what the touch points are. Let's understand what needed to be done. Obviously, then had to go into negotiations with Barclays. To strike a number, and then as I said, it took us 3 years to untangle this the entanglement. Mm-hmm. So big part, and I think that for me again, we're very proud that we've been able to deliver this on time and on budget. Having substantially achieved it by the 5th of June. I can distinctly remember in the beginning of the journey, we said, well, we better need to make sure that we can get some experiences from other banks that has done some of these things in the past, and therefore we did a bit of an international trip, and the key message coming out of this from most of the banks was like, listen, if you plan for 3 years, add a year and add 50% to your budget because you're going to get it wrong. These things are complex. So with those messages, ended where we're ending now, we're extremely proud that we've been able to do that.
Right. So you mentioned it was substantially done by June, but there's still some loose ends to be tied up, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, there's literally three projects, two of which subsequent to the 5th of June has already been completed. The third one will be completed sort of in the fourth quarter of this year. And it was really, you know, we had a slight slowdown in terms of COVID. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whilst most of the work was the one that's remaining, most of the work has been completed. It's just the customer migrations that need to take place. And we wanted to do it in a responsible way. So, but from our perspective, it's done and dusted. The heavy lifting is done. There's no more risk in us getting this over and done with. And by December, it should be all in bed.
So you completed this during the hard lockdown. Was that challenging? I mean, were most of your IT teams working remotely when you were completing this project?
Yeah. Duncan, most of the heavy lifting was sort of done last year. Okay. We had a tail end of projects that we had to finalize this year. COVID brought its own challenges. We had to move people off site very, very quickly.
Yes.
And proud to say at this point in time, we have on average 25,000 people a day working from home. Even some of our call center staff and service desk staff are working from home. We had one or two initial glitches dealing with the volumes, but within a week or so, we were up and running. And it's amazing how people have just taken to things that we never thought could happen, off-site, has just suddenly happened. Most of the completion then done from an off-site perspective.
Let's explore this in a little bit of detail. I know it's slightly off subject, but I think it is very interesting. So the president in March announced the hard lockdown was coming on the 27th of March. What went through your mind when you heard that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the first thing was, are we ready? You prepare for these things. But before lockdown, the most people we had concurrently working from home was 1,800. So, yeah, people occasionally work from home. It wasn't something that we did, aggressively. People were allowed to do that, but suddenly you realize that, within a week, things need to change. And as I said, luckily, I think from a systems perspective, we were relatively well set up in terms of our virtual private networks. We made some changes and tweaks in between, and we continued to test some new technology. Teams was rolled out last year as part of also the separation program. So we were ready, but, we were pushing and prodding people to start using Teams, and we were thinking about change management programs to get people to start adopting this technology. Mm-hmm. Within a week, we had 400,000 meetings a week that took place. Yeah. So that whole thing about change management and getting people to adopt new technology, I've also changed my mind on that. You don't need hundreds of people convincing people. Sometimes it's just an event like this that will just fundamentally change people and the way they do things. We also see it from digital adoption, from our customer perspective, in past years, we would move that dial with smaller percentage points through very hard work. Mm-hmm. Through this lockdown period, we've just seen that adoption, jump, double digits very quickly as customers start to adopt. So, obviously lots of bad things around the pandemic. But I think certainly from a technology perspective and a technology adoption perspective, I think the world has fundamentally changed and will be changed forever.
Yeah. So do you see a larger proportion of your employees working from home going into the future, even after the pandemic?
Yeah. Listen. We're having a lot of debates on it, and our instruction to our tech teams at the moment is not don't come back. So we will be reducing space. I think we in our initial thinking. We will consolidate in our tech campus in Randburg. We would prefer our people to stay and work from home. Obviously, we'll create space for people to come in, one or two days a week. We've done quite a bit to set our people up working from home, allowing them to take chairs and monitors and so on to be able and obviously get the right equipment and data is a big thing. But our thinking certainly is that there's much to be had in terms of work from home going forward and lots of benefits, certainly from a property perspective. I don't want to be a commercial property holder at this moment. I think at the end of leases, you're just going to see people moving out. So from our perspective, the same. We will probably create space for 1,000 tech people in Randburg to work. We have 3,000 tech people plus 2,500 contractors at any point in time. So that gives you an indication. Yeah, strategy very much continue to do the work from home thing.
Fascinating. Let's come back to the Barclays separation now. There must have been some big milestones along the way during this project, and I'd imagine some heart-stopping moments potentially where you cut the systems across. Maybe take us through one or two of those moments that you.
One that certainly jumps to mind is our Africa country. Six of our Africa countries runs off a system called Brains, the core banking solution for the African countries. That was obviously a Barclays system, which we had to transfer, sitting in a data center in the UK. It was one of the big changes that we had to make. That and the digital system supporting our African countries. I think we probably did five or six dress rehearsals where we, through military position, went through the process up to the point of flicking the switch of switching over to the countries, looked at issues that arose, planned better, did another dress rehearsal. A core banking solution, lifting and dropping that, from one data center to the other is probably like taking a 747 into the air and changing engines. And so that was a harrowing one. That was a big one, moving the core banking and the digital solutions to South Africa. It went down without a glitch. Because of practice, that again is just practice, and that then makes the team more comfortable, and it went really, really smoothly. So that would be one of them. It didn't go without glitches. There were one or two programs where we had to intervene and make some specific calls and changing direction. Those are always tough. With tech programs, and that's probably a learning as well. You tend to get to a point where you've invested quite a lot of money. You're scared to make the call, and you continue to invest. And you might find yourself 4 years later having sunk a significant amount of money and a point of no return. So for us, that's one of the things also in our travels that we chatted about in preparing for this is let's be brave enough to make the right decisions at the right time. And I think we've made a couple of those where we got to really harrowing situations. The product that we chose wasn't turning out to be what we believed. We cut our losses, we made a change, and we still delivered the program within the time frame. So for me, that's potentially as technologists, we sometimes scared to make some of those calls. And then, as I said, you find yourself four years along the line having spent multiple millions and the thing is still not bringing benefit. So for me, that was really, there was a couple of harrowing moments. We stuck to our guns, made the right call, exited what we were busy with, started afresh again, and still managed to deliver it, within the overall time frame. So it wasn't easy. And credit to our people. I mean, yes, our teams, some of our teams, Duncan, when I looked at some of the stats at the height of it, we're working like 35 out of the 52 weekends in a year just to get this change into the environment. Remember, we had the bank to run, so we had to keep systems stable. We had a customer base that wanted to transact, and then we had this massive flood of change coming into the in addition, and therefore it took tremendous effort from the team, and they did so well. I'm so proud of the team in terms of what they managed to achieve.
It's interesting what you say about that willingness to give up on particular technology decisions or technology routes or products that you've decided to pursue, because I think we've seen it elsewhere in corporate South Africa and probably elsewhere in the banking sector in South Africa, where a decision is taken to go a particular route and then the organization decides, well, we're going to stick with this because this is the decision we made. This is the route we're going to go. And then the IT project ends up costing two or three times what was originally budgeted because they've had so many problems that they've had to fix along the way. Yeah. So it's actually quite interesting what you say there. And it's probably quite an interesting IT management skill to have, to be able to say, well, actually, we've made a mistake here. Let's revisit it and go back on it.
Duncan, absolutely, and it's not easy. Remember, you've got the eyes of the board and the exco on you. Yeah. They don't like wasting money, and they ask the tough questions. But guess what? Sometimes you do make mistakes. Things do change. what you think you're going to end up is not ultimately what you end up. You make the wrong choices. And for me, that is probably a core skill, and you've got to be brave. And luckily, we had the backing of our executive as well. There was no witch hunts in terms of, you know, why are we wasting money? I think that's also important. So top leadership has got to be flexible and got to understand that that's the nature of technology. Yep. And that you sometimes have to change. I mean, we've had a couple of examples where we've invested in the technology, and a year, you know, into it, or 2 years into it, there's something that's certainly better and that can benefit our customers. And being able to make that change, I think, is absolutely required. And it takes tough discussions, and it sometimes put a bit of pressure on you. But if you don't do that, you might end up with more egg on your face later.
Now, given the importance of Absa as a bank in the financial services sector in South Africa, I imagine, and in the region more generally, I imagine that there was a lot of regulatory oversight, a lot of regulatory interest in this separation project. Is that the case? And if so, what role did the regulators play in this project?
Yeah, very much. So, I mean, this was a three-year program, and there was regulatory and legal requirements that we had to meet. So there was a legal document, a transition agreement between us and Barclays that we had to comply with. And if we didn't comply with, there would be consequences. So, you know, it would cost us more, there would be potential penalties. And then obviously the regulators, because of the systemic nature of this, was also very, 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 very concerned. So regular communication with regulators on both sides of the pond. So obviously the prudential authorities in the UK were watching this thing like a hawk. Also for Barclays to get to the point where they could deconsolidate from a regulatory perspective, there were certain things that they had to meet. And then the African regulators actually formed the College of Regulators. So, it would have been very difficult in dealing, with each and every regulator on its own. So there was a college formed, and we had quarterly meetings and feedback sessions with these guys to really update them and keep them posted. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, lots of time spent, in the rooms with the regulators, giving them assurances, and obviously, yeah, very concerned that there could be systemic risk in their countries, or anything that could introduce issues. So very, very closely watched, for us also. But for us, it was really good that we could land this thing and give the proof that what we committed to initially we could make.
Well, Helen, before we wrap, let's talk about what this means for Absa going forward. Now, I imagine that when you're involved in a project of this scale, multi-year project of this scale, that it is the risk that you end up navel-gazing to a large extent, that you are focused internally on getting this project done, perhaps at the exclusion, potentially, of innovation, of innovating products for your end users, of potentially even keeping up with what's happening in the competitive landscape. Did you find that there was an element of that during this project? I imagine it's almost inevitable that would happen. And now that the project's over, do you expect that Absa is going to be able to innovate a lot quicker on a new technology platform to deliver new services to customers?
Yeah. So Duncan, I mean, I think it's a really good question. And I think initially everybody was nervous, and specifically the analyst community, in terms of, does this mean Absa is going to take their eye off the ball? So there's a lot of concern around, is this internally focused for Absa for the next 3 years? I think when we set out to start this program, we looked at it and we said, if we spend this check that was given to us, and it was a big one, as you mentioned, and we come out on the other side the same, then we would have failed. So the objective was really to set the bank up and to transform. And I can tell you now that the transformation that we achieved, inside the bank, from a pure infrastructure perspective, from a customer-facing application perspective, has been astounding. I think if it wasn't for separation, we would have potentially taken 5 or 6 years to do the same with our own money and our own investment. The fact that we had this and we planned it properly, I think, has set the bank up beautifully. So I think the contrary happened. I think, Absa comes out of this a lot stronger, a lot more ready to implement in our strategy. and you know, with a modern infrastructure and really modern applications. So you know, it might have been you know, perceived as being internally focused. I think the way we approached it and the way we delivered it has set us up beautifully for the future. So I'm quite excited about where we are, what we've done, the innovations that we've built in, and you know, watch the space. I think we're going to do well going forward.
So what are your big projects once this is all done? What are you focusing on next?
Yeah. So I alluded to you know, the cloud journey, which you know, really has to do with setting us up to be more agile and be able to respond to customer demands a lot quicker. So that's really what it's all about, being you know, allowing our teams that flexibility to be able to follow the market and to follow customer demand, really being close to the business. So that will be really one of our big things. You know, obviously we have to take a look at the future. So getting ourselves ready for open banking, I think is one of those things that is really, really important. You know, we hear a lot about APIs. For me, you know, it's got to be APIs for a purpose. What is it that you want to do? You know, do you want to open up everything in the bank? I don't think so. Are there select things that you do want to open up? I think absolutely. So I think that will be driving a lot quicker. We're doing some interesting things. You know, one of the key things that we doing now is something called Fraud Fabric, which is really setting up, you know, our ability to deal with the constant changing threat environment out there. You know, making use of things like machine learning, et cetera, bring different profiles from different angles together to be able to detect some of these things more. That's something that will take a lot of attention. And then, you know, customer facing innovation ongoing. You know, we recently took our vehicle finance solution and you know, redesigned it from end to end and put a new solution in the marketplace, which is proving to be fantastic. The dealers love it. We can get give credit a lot quicker than potentially our competitors. So those are the type of innovations that we'll continue to chase. We're looking at some of the other product sets to make sure that they're in the same category. So really, you know, setting ourselves up for flexibility, chasing that customer-facing innovations. And then I think the other thing, you know, that we have realized is you can't do everything alone. This is all about ecosystems. This is all about partners. And that's another thing that we're pursuing quite strongly to make sure that we can stay competitive and we can really beat the competitors handsomely going forward.
Lastly, I'm sure there'll be other CIOs watching or listening to this podcast who are going through similar projects to the one Apps has just been through, probably not at the same sort of scale, but maybe facing similar challenges in their futures. What advice would you give to those CIOs, given what you have learned over the last few years, in terms of how to approach a project like this? And is there anything you'd do differently now with the benefit of hindsight, if you were to go back to the start of this project again and with that knowledge now, is there something you would change in the way you approached this project?
Yeah, a couple of things I think that's important. I talked about marriages do not always work. So if you plan, don't think the environment's not going to change. So you've got to plan and be flexible. I think that's probably one of the most important things. The other important thing from my perspective is that old saying of measure twice, cut once. Planning is just so important. You know, rather spend double the time on planning, and then your execution will go well. So I think that's really important. No substitute for practice. I mean, I talked about the dress rehearsals. I think we had about 47 or 48 dress rehearsals across the different areas, just practicing, you know, getting things right, ironing out potential issues, and then, you know, moving into the big switchovers. That really is important. I think people is important. You've got to have the best people, and you know, I'm proud to say we've got some of the best technologists and some of the best people in the bank, and keeping those teams motivated and making sure that they work towards a common goal and they enjoy what they're doing, I think is really good. We talked about the don't be scared to change. I mean, don't be scared to change your decision, even if it comes with consequences and money going down. And then for me, this you know, wouldn't have worked if it wasn't for a great relationship with PLC, with Barclays.
Right.
You know, we planned together. We then, you know, had some disagreements about how things should be done and what the price tag for this should be. But after that, we came together again, and they supported us beautifully throughout the journey. It's not a one-sided thing. You can't do a merger or a demerger, you know, without both parties being fully invested. And I think that was really one of the success stories for us in terms of this. Doing things differently, you know, Duncan, I think, initially we were, a bit obsessed in getting external people to tell us what to do. We had lots of consultants running around and pulling big decks and best practices together. And initially that, I think, held us back a bit. At some point in time, we just said, we've got the confidence to do it on our own. And you should probably trust that.
Yes.
Nobody can tell you how to do your business better than yourselves. So that would be potentially one of the things that I think we got wrong in the beginning. Luckily, again, we came to a point where we said we have the confidence to do it on our own, and we actually did it. So but for the rest of it, you know, as I said, immensely proud that the teams managed to land us on time, on budget. Very very little issues, and it's a great success story and something that it happens once in a lifetime and something I think that the teams can be very proud of.
Absolutely. Well, Wilhelm, thanks so much for sharing your insights into this project. It's been very, very interesting to learn about it. And I'm sure CIOs and IT managers in other organizations will be fascinated to hear about how Absa went about this project. Wilhelm Kricher is Chief Information Officer at Absa Group. Thanks so much for talking to Tech Central.
Thanks, Duncan. Appreciate it.